Hello, I'm Eric Corman, Communications Director at League of Education Voters. In this podcast, we interview policymakers, partners, and thought leaders to spotlight education policies, research, and practices so that together we can create a brighter future for every Washington student. Dr. Jennifer Eberhardt is a professor of psychology at Stanford, a recipient of a 2014 MacArthur Genius Grant, and is considered one of the world's leading experts on implicit racial bias. She has been elected to the National Academy of Sciences, the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and was named one of Foreign Policy's 100 leading global thinkers. She is the co-founder and co-director of SPARK, Social Psychological Answers to Real-World Questions, a Stanford center that brings together researchers and practitioners to address significant social problems. Dr. Eberhardt's new book is Biased, Uncovering the Hidden Prejudice That Shapes What We See, Think, and Do. Dr. Eberhardt, what exactly is implicit bias?
Yes, so implicit bias can be defined as the beliefs and the feelings we have about social groups that can influence our decisions and our actions even when we're not aware of it.
So how does that manifest itself?
Well, it can manifest itself in lots of ways. And so, you know, it can influence how we see our neighbors, who we pay attention to and think is suspicious. It could influence educators in terms of how they discipline and who they discipline in schools. It can influence managers and how they decide who gets hired and who gets a promotion, say. And it can influence jurors in the criminal justice system. It can influence even death sentencing decisions. So just about every aspect of our lives, it can actually infect the decisions we make and the actions we take.
Yeah, at the beginning of your book, Biased, you tell a story about being with your son on an airplane. And I thought that is one of the best examples of implicit bias. Would you mind telling that story?
Yeah, so I'm on the plane with my son. He's only 5 years old at the time, and he's looking around. He's all excited about being on the plane with mom. And so he sees this man on the plane, and he says, "Hey, that guy looks like Daddy." And I look at the guy. He didn't look anything at all, by the way, like my husband. And so I start looking around, and I just noticed he was the only black man on the plane. So I'm all set to have this discussion with him about how not all black people look alike. And then before I could have that discussion, he looks up and he says to me, "I hope he doesn't rob the plane." Mm. And I said, "What? What did you say?" And he said it again, "I hope he doesn't rob the plane." And I said, "You know, Daddy wouldn't rob a plane. Why would you say that?" And he looked at me and with this really sad face, and he says, "I don't know why I said that. I don't know why I was thinking that." And it is a good example of implicit bias, right? Because somehow that got in his head, but he wasn't aware that it was there and didn't really have a sense of how it got there. And we're discussing it, and he's trying to figure it out. But it definitely, you know, was affecting how he, you know, saw that man. And then years later, now that he's a teenager, he's experiencing being on, you know, the other side of that formula, right? So now he has grown big enough to be a threat and for people to look at him as the criminal or as the bad guy.
How is your son dealing with that now that he's 15?
You know, it's hard when you realize that this is going to be your fate in a way, that the world has changed, and because of you growing older, that people are just going to respond to you differently. And I think he's still grappling with how he should respond, and he definitely, you know, feels like there's something different now in how people, you know, look at him and how they think about them, how they move away from him, and so forth. And so it's a hard identity to begin to wear.
Yeah, I can imagine. And the idea of him having these biases, even when he was 5 years old, that shows you how deeply ingrained it seems to be into our culture. How did it get there?
I think the first thing people point to would be the media. They say, "Oh, well, you know, you get that from watching television and all of that." But, you know, this is a time, I mean, you're pretty young, and he wasn't even watching that much television, actually. And I think part of it comes from the disparities that are out there, racial disparities and the incarceration rate and the crime rate and so forth. And so you can kind of get that maybe through the news or maybe even listening to the radio as I'm driving him back and forth, you know, to school and so forth. I think also another place they get it is just from us, from everyday people, and watching how we move through the world and what that signals about who we value, who we fear, and so forth. I had another son who, when he was a first grader, noticed that, when a guy came into the grocery store, black guy in a white neighborhood, that people seemed to move out of the way a bit. And then when he stood in line, he told me his was the shortest line for the long time, and he wanted to know whether people just thought about black people in a different way from other people. I said, I don't know. I said, what do you think that means? And he was thinking about it and thinking about what that behavior meant to him and signaled to him. And he thought about it, and he says, I think it's fear. So a first grader, right, he's already getting a sense of who is to be feared and who is feared in our society. So it's not just the media. I mean, it's really us, our own behavior, and what leaks out as we move through the world.
Yeah, and it's particularly interesting that an African-American child would get that as well, because you would imagine that, maybe white children might get that from their white parents, that bias, but it transcends culture, it transcends race. Why do you think that is?
So there's lots of research on that, and oftentimes you can show that, say, African-Americans will show the same kinds of biases as other Americans or white Americans in particular, and it's because it's not based on simple prejudice or old-fashioned racism. It's not based on just having a bad heart, which I think a lot of people think it is. And it's just about being exposed to the same stuff, living in that same world, and it starts to seep into your brain, and your brain's making sense of it, and you start to develop these associations. And then as you practice those associations, as you see those things being connected, blackness and crime, say, over and over again, it becomes automatic. And so it's easy to do. That's a connection that's easy for your brain to make, without thought even, or without any animus even.
And it happens at such a young age. And I think about schools, for example. If you look at the suspension rates among preschoolers, the rates of African-American preschoolers is so much higher than other cultures. And then I imagine that going through K-12 and how teachers have this implicit bias and principals and other educators. What can you do in schools to start undoing this?
Yeah, it's hard. So I've done a study with a former graduate student, Jason Okonifa, where we asked that same question, right? And here we were interested in what the disparities meant, because there was a lot of argument about that. So it could be an indication of the teacher's implicit bias that you have disparities in discipline. Or, it could be that there's actually a difference in terms of how children are behaving in school. And so it was hard to know, with correlational work, which it was. And so we did, an experimental study, or this controlled study, where we gave practicing teachers, an image, of a school, and we asked them to, imagine teaching at that school. And then we gave them an office referral record, and we just simply changed the name on the record. So it either was a stereotypically black-sounding name, like Darnell or Jamal, or it was a stereotypically white name, like Greg, for example. Child misbehaved in some mild ways, getting up, getting tissues from a tissue box and disrupting the class a bit there. And we asked the teachers to tell us, how severe is this misbehavior? And is this child hindering your class? And would you want to discipline him? And how much? And all of this. We saw no race differences there. But when we said, hey, 3 days later, the same child misbehaves again, this time he's sleeping in class, you ask him to wake up and do his work and he refuses, there we see huge race difference come online. So at this point now, black Darnell, his misbehavior is seen as way worse than white Greg, even though it's identical, right? They think that he's more of a hindrance to the class. They want to discipline him a lot more. And when we did follow-up studies to try to understand why is this happening, right? Sort of why is race having this kind of impact on teachers? We found that for the white child, they just saw the behaviors as completely unrelated. So one sort of infraction had nothing to do with the other. It was completely separate. But for black Darnell, those infractions were connected. It was indicative of a pattern of misbehavior. They were more inclined to label Black Darnell as a troublemaker than White Greg for the same infractions. And so, and not only that, they could see Black Darnell getting suspended down the road. I mean, and this is starting with sleeping in class, and already all this comes online where you can imagine this child being suspended, you know, years later. So yeah, so there's evidence for real bias there. And in fact, we just completed a recent study where we looked at the region of the country that the teachers were from, and we found that the race effects were strongest in areas of the country where you had the strongest racial bias. So it's not just something that's in the teacher's head, it's seeping in for them too, like the region that they're in, this bias that's out there in the community is coming into the schoolhouse and affecting how they see this child.
Yeah, it seems so much about the narrative. Like, you know, if you can see the child as a whole person, like maybe he's sleeping in class because his parents had to, you know, work a second or a third job and they came home late and he was trying to sleep and then he got woken up by his parents coming home, or maybe he wanted to see mom since he hadn't seen her all day. Yeah. I know in the case of my son, I have a 10-year-old son and he's Asian, he's Korean, and he goes to a mostly white school. And there have been cases where he has done the exact same behavior as some of his white peers, and yet just because he's a different skin color, he'll be the one that'll get disciplined or singled out, even though what he was doing was exactly the same. And part of my challenge has been to basically lay out a narrative as to, you know, why my son might be doing certain things.
Right. So with the teachers, you mean?
Yeah, with the teachers, exactly, so that they don't see him as a problem, because guess what? Originally they did. But then once I changed the narrative and was able to give them more information, then they wanted to help him instead of discipline him. I thought that was fascinating.
It is fascinating. So there's another study. I mean, so you initially asked me about what do you do? And so Jason, the former graduate student that I work with, he went on to actually try some studies to figure out ways to intervene on this. And that's exactly what he and his collaborators did. They gave teachers another way to think about that child. So in this case, they gave them another way to think about discipline. So the purpose of discipline isn't to punish the child, but the purpose is to help the child to develop. The purpose is to try to build a trusting relationship with that child so you can kind of steer him or her in the right direction. And so they got the teachers to reframe how they thought about discipline. And that simple reframing had a huge effect. It actually, they were able to cut the discipline rate in half just with that simple manipulation, just that simple change in the mindset of the teachers of that school. And it also changed the mindset of the students, even though they weren't in the study, right? They're just being affected by what the teachers have done. But for those who had teachers who actually were in the study and got the shift in their mindset, they trusted their teachers more. Even for, you know, students who had been disciplined before, they trusted the teachers a lot more and were less likely to misbehave and so forth.
Seems like it's all about relationship and also giving students what they need to succeed, because, you know, maybe an African-American student or a Native American student, you know, might not be doing well in class because they don't, you know, understand or need some additional supports with the curriculum. And then, you know, maybe you give them some reading help or explain the math in a different way, or maybe do it in a way that's more culturally competent, like, you know, really appreciating where they're coming from and then, you know, tailoring their classroom experience to reflect their backgrounds. Maybe that would be a good way to build those relationships so that everybody wins.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And there's research on that as well, supporting exactly that. There's research, for example, that was conducted by Jeff Cohen and colleagues, where they, you know, allow children to express the values that they care about, and they have teachers ask them to write about their values. And that simple task of writing about your values in the school context, it signals to the children that the school cares about my values, the teachers care about my values, they care about me. And then in writing about the values, the teachers actually get a better sense of the child. Like, they understand the child more. You know what I mean? So they come into view in a way that they don't if you're just kind of using their category or using a stereotype, say, to figure out who they are. And so those children just writing about values in that setting, for them and for the teachers, everything is improved. And so they're academic performance shoots up, and it's something that can get sustained across years.
So what can we do for society at large, though? I mean, yes, there's a lot we can do in schools, and if we can have an awareness of celebrating culture and not othering culture from the get-go when kids start preschool even. I mean, that's great for kids who are coming up through our society, but what about people who are already adults? What can we do about implicit bias there?
I think there's a lot we can do. I mean, just because, you know, this is something that we're not always aware of and can kind of sneak up on us, and it's more subtle. I call it, like, you know, when people think about old-fashioned racism, right? I mean, that's a pretty acute form, you know, of bias. But we're talking about something that's more like a chronic condition where maybe you don't know it's there. It only flares up at certain times, and you have to monitor it, say, to make sure that it doesn't flare up too much. And implicit bias is kind of like that, something that's kind of there beneath the surface, but it's not always going to affect your decision making. It's not always going to surface and to affect your actions. There are some situations that make it much more likely that it's going to get triggered. And so as social scientists, we know a lot about what those triggers are, and to the extent that other people know, I mean, this is for adults too, not just kids, right? Yeah. To the extent that we all know, you know, as a society, we can start to protect ourselves from the bias that might impact our decision making and actions. I can give you an example.
Yeah.
Acting quickly and sort of thinking quickly, like when you have to make a decision really fast, sometimes because we don't have time to really think it through, we fall back on these automatic associations that we already have, and we kind of use them to help to inform our decision making. So just slowing down is one, you know, method that you could use to protect yourself from bias. Another is if we're cognitively depleted, so we're tired, or if we're stressed, you know, if we're feeling threatened, sort of all of those states actually make it a little more likely when we're taking an action that bias is going to be involved in that action that we're taking. There's a long list of these things, even sort of increasing your positive contact with people who are in other social categories and other groups, that positive contact actually can protect us from bias in some cases. Even how we monitor the behavior of others can affect us. So if you're using subjective standards to evaluate the performance, say, of other people, bias can assert itself. You see this a lot with gender, like with women in the workplace.
Yeah.
If you're evaluating people on these subjective standards, whether you like them and whether they're a team player and those kinds of things, and not on how much did they bring in sales, or, you know, how many partners, you know, did they, you know, whatever the sort of objective standards of your trade might be. When you get to the objective standards, there's less room for bias than if you're evaluating people simply on the basis of subjective standards. So there are lots and lots of ways in which we can protect ourselves. We're vulnerable to bias, but we can manage it by understanding when it's going to flare up and how, and being mindful of that, especially when we're in situations where we know that it's possible.
Yeah, you mentioned a couple of triggers. If we have to make a decision quickly, or if we're tired, for example, what are some other triggers, just so that we can be aware of them to say, hey, wait a minute, I'm in a situation where I might be biased, so I'm going to take a step back and, as you said, slow down.
Yeah, so using this, you know, subjective standards to evaluate someone, I think that's a big one, and that we do all the time. And actually, this is an example from the policing industry. In the NYPD, when they stop people on the streets of New York City, they're required to complete a form to say why they stopped them and where they stopped them and who they stopped and the outcome of the stop and so forth. They're required to list what the reason was for the stop. And so there were 10 different options that they could choose on that form. And one was furtive movement. But they couldn't tell you what furtive movement meant, right? There was no agreed upon definition by the department of what furtive movement was. And so that left officers, it gave them great license, right, to determine what furtive movement or what sort of suspicious movement meant to them.
Yep.
And so you could pull people over and based on this standard that could shift for different people, and when you're in different locations of the city, it could shift, and if you're looking at someone black versus white, it could shift, and so there wasn't an agreed-upon definition. So they ended up actually removing that item from the stop form that they have to complete, and the stops, a number of stops plummeted. Now, there are lots of other reforms that they've tried in New York, and I have to say I'm actually a member of the federal monitoring team that's there, and so
that's great.
Yeah, so there are lots of reforms that are going on right now, but that was one of them. I guess I raised that one because that's a simple one. It's just removing, you know, this subjective standard so that you're not using it anymore, and when you can't use it, it actually is making a big difference.
So I'm thinking about my son again. He's 10 years old. What should I say to him about this? Because I have to have a conversation, obviously, and I try to have racial conversations from time to time. Like, I'll point out the race of different people in our lives or people that we'll see on TV or walking down the street sometimes. He even says that he's afraid of homeless people sometimes, which I thought was interesting. Yeah. And I ask him, so why are you afraid of homeless people? And he thinks that they might be dangerous.
Yeah.
And I want to not be colorblind because I don't think that that's going to help anything. Race is such a part of our identity, and to
yes.
be colorblind, you're basically denying that part of identity.
Yes.
What should I say to my son?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, I could start with the comment you made about homeless people because mm-hmm. there's research on that too. So there's some work by Lasana Harris and Susan Fisk at Princeton. It was a neuroimaging study that they did. They showed people in the scanner pictures of other people. And normally when you see a picture of another person, there's an area of the brain that gets excited, right?
Mm-hmm.
It kind of lights up. And that's the left medial prefrontal cortex, so this front part of our brain. But when they showed them pictures of homeless people, that area was silent.
Wow.
It didn't light up. It's not responding. And so it's like if you've lost your home, there's a way in which people feel like you've lost your humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that your child could even see that is interesting. I mean, that so it's something that starts early. And so that area of the brain, this left medial prefrontal cortex, is silent. But what's active is the amygdala.
Ah.
And that's the area of the brain that's implicated in fear and so forth, which your son also talked about. Yeah, children pick it up and then they practice it over and over until that becomes this automatic response when you pass a person who is homeless. And so mm-hmm. it's about, like you said at the beginning, I think changing the narrative and helping people to understand why people might be in the situation that they're in. I think we as Americans think that we're in a situation that we're in usually because it's our own making, it's our own choices and so forth, and we don't see the structural elements that conspire to sort of push people in certain ways so that they're in certain conditions and push other people in a different direction. I think that's harder for us to think about, and even our language isn't kind of built for that. So some contemplation about that, like having those kinds of discussions with your son about why people are in the situations that they're in, having some discussion about history. Just I learned so much even just from writing the book Bias, right? You know, there's a survey of teachers asking about them teaching slavery. And it turns out, I think it's only like 8% of, you know, K through 12 students actually know that slavery played a major role in why we had a civil war.
Wow.
8%.
Wow.
Yeah. And then
amazing.
When they, in this survey, they ask teachers about teaching, say, and they say they want to teach it, but they don't know how to teach it. Again, they don't know how to have conversation about race. And they're worried, some of them, about how the students of color, especially the black students, would feel in the class if you mm-hmm. had such a conversation. And so it's hard to do. And even the textbooks, it's kind of a, I don't know, what do you call it, like a whitewashing, or what do you call that? Like it's a, you don't really actually understand the terror and the horror of it
yeah.
By how it's written about.
Yeah,
so.
That is a whitewashing.
Okay.
Ironically.
Oh, yeah. That's funny. Mm-hmm. So I think education is huge here mm-hmm. in combating bias and helping people to think in a different way and shifting the narratives that we have about people and about their deservingness and so forth.
Do you think that education is the way to attack structural and institutional racism?
Well, I don't think there's one way. I think education and educators can play a huge role in this, in helping us to sort of understand why people are situated in the way that they are and the role of history and so forth in that. But I think also we have to work with policymakers. I mean, a lot of why people are in the situations that they're in, it has to do with policies that we as a country decided we wanted to pursue. Even simple things, well, I shouldn't say it's simple in the way that it doesn't matter, but things that happened long ago can still be affecting us, like policies that we had around segregation, you know, neighborhood segregation, still with us today. I mean, you could still, we still live in segregated spaces, as there's a legacy to that. And our brains function differently because of that, right? Because when we're in segregated spaces, we're only seeing people who are like us in our same racial group, and our brain gets practiced on those kinds of faces and learns to be highly attuned to those kinds of faces and not faces of people of other racial groups. And they say, there's research on this, even babies as young as 3 months of age can already they're showing a preference for faces of their own race. That's not just about brain wiring. It's about what the brain is feeding on. And a lot of that has to do with our social environment, and that has to do with the policies that create those social environments.
Can you ever imagine a society where we embrace all races?
That's a hard one. I mean, I can imagine a society where we're doing a whole lot better than what we're doing now. So I'll leave it at that.
Dr. Jennifer Eberhardt's new book is Biased, Uncovering the Hidden Prejudice That Shapes What We See, Think, and Do. Dr. Eberhardt, thank you so much for stopping by.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening. To learn more about League of Education Voters or to support our work, please visit educationvoters.org.